Music is one of the most abstract art forms, but that was a storm, no doubt about it. And if you keep listening, you'll even realize it's a storm at sea, from the rising and falling strings and woodwinds imitating the sound of lapping surf. This is no polite overture meant to kill time while latecomers find their seats. This is a catastrophe with earth-shattering thunder and lightning. Even if you are unsure about the musical imagery, the shocked, brooding lines of the male chorus tell us everything we need to know. A sail, a banner, it's the winged lion. An Italian audience hearing this at the premiere of Verdi's new opera in 1887 might not have recognized the story from these opening words alone, but it certainly would have been enough for them to recognize the setting. My name is Anthony Freud. I'm the General Director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and today I'm speaking to you about Giuseppe Verdi's penultimate opera, Otello. The winged lion on that banner is for St. Mark the Evangelist, patron saint of La Serenissima, the most serene maritime republic of Venice. Doesn't sound very serene at the moment, but then most serene here means sovereign, not taking a siesta back later. Specifically, it means that a high Venetian official is on board, and the chorus on shore watches helplessly as the ship tries to claw its way into port. That cannon at the end was fired by the foundering ship. They're trying to make sure everyone on shore knows they're in trouble, so they can be ready to assist if the storm abates. But who is playing a trumpet at the beginning of that excerpt? Uno squillo, the crowd screams. Squillo is shorthand for squillo di tromba, literally the shriek of a trumpet. So it's not just pretty orchestration. The characters on stage are hearing a trumpet, just as they heard the cannon being fired. It's not clear if this trumpet is meant to be ashore or on board the thrashing ship. The stage directions call for the sound to come from the scene in the distance, but Verdi must have felt this storm in the pit of his stomach to write that music, and he can't have imagined a lone trumpeter playing away on a pitching deck. Whether the trumpeter is an honor guard meant to greet the arriving commander, or a lone voice awash in danger, his instrument represents the central colossus of the opera, the mysterious title character who has yet to be revealed. The mystery for Verdi's opening night audience would have been profound. By 1887, Verdi had been the representative of Italian opera for almost half a century. But he had retired 16 years before, after the premiere of Aida in 1871. In the interim, almost all of the important opera news had come from across the Alps, where Wagner was opening his Festspielhaus in Bayreuth with the first complete presentation of The Ring of the Nibelungs. The principal instrument on which Verdi had risen to fame and fortune was the human voice. But in opera, the importance of the individual voice appeared to be on the decline. Wagner had pioneered the use of leitmotifs, short musical phrases associated with characters, places, or ideas. And with them came a rise in the dramatic functions of the opera orchestra. Orchestras were bigger and were being given more to do. In an effort to increase the dramatic intensity of works, set-piece arias had been swept away in a tidal wave of orchestration. An opera was now expected to be through-composed. The music would start when the curtain went up, and it wouldn't stop until the end of the act. Wagner had thrown the lightning bolts, but the storm had spread. Many of the rising names in the next generation of opera composers would not be Italian. And even in Italy, change was afoot. Leoncavallo and Puccini were already writing works that owed a great deal to Wagner, and the first Verismo opera, Pietro Mascagni's Cavalleria Rusticana, would premiere in 1890. There was no question of the love of the Italian people for their famous composer. But was it nostalgia? Italian political unification, the cause so viscerally associated with the younger Giuseppe Verdi had already happened. And in 1887, Verdi himself was in his 70s. Writing about the Otello premiere years later, Verdi would remember orchestra members grasping his hand on the stairs. On their faces were engraved these words, Verdi wrote, "Maestro, we will never see each other again here, never again." What would Verdi's music sound like after his long hiatus? The composer had explicitly rejected Wagner's musical theories. Would his Othello be another Macbeth, beautiful but flawed, and now somehow dated? The opening scene of Othello would sweep away any doubt that the genius of Busetto had grown, not shrunk, with age. The musical excerpts you're hearing are from an EMI Classics recording featuring Placido Domingo as Othello, Katia Ricciarelli as Desdemona, and Justino Diaz as Iago. Lauren Mazel conducts the chorus and orchestra of La Scala. Special thanks to EMI for allowing us to use their recording, and to Nicholas Ivor Martin for writing this commentary. The tension in Verdi's Storm is as palpable as the sea spray, and when it breaks at last and Othello steps ashore, the release is thunderous. Esultate, exultation indeed. The orchestra are not the only ones thrown into the maelstrom without a warm-up. The combination of big leaps and high notes make that one of the most difficult opening lines for tenor in all opera. Notice also that for all the composer's protestations that Wagner has it wrong, Othello is essentially through-composed. So where did that storm come from? Actually, Shakespeare, sort of. The Shakespeare play opens in Venice, where the military hero Othello has just married Desdemona in secret, to the chagrin of her family. Othello is a Moor, so while he is employed by the Venetian Republic, there's little doubt that he's a foreigner and an outsider. Desdemona's father thinks Othello has used magic to seduce her, and he pleads his case in front of the Venetian Senate. But while he's doing so, news arrives that the Turks are about to attack the Venetian island of Cyprus. Since the Republic needs Othello to lead the defense of Cyprus, they're just looking for an excuse to discredit Desdemona's father. And Desdemona herself gives it to them, appearing in the Senate chamber to answer the charge that Othello is a sorcerer. Desdemona assures them that she loved him for his military prowess alone. As she says, "that I did love the Moor to live with him, my downright violence and storm of fortunes may trumpet to the world." Case closed. Next. Notice that storms and trumpets figure prominently in descriptions of Desdemona's fortunes and of her hero. In Shakespeare's Act II, Iago announces, "The Moor, I know his trumpet," and Othello thunders in, accompanied by his warriors fresh from victory. But where is Desdemona going to go while Othello is away in Cyprus? She's no longer welcome to stay with her family, so the Venetian Doge asks what she wants to do. "Let me go with him," Desdemona answers without hesitation. Shakespeare based his play on a short story, The Moor of Venice, written by Giraldi Cintio in 1565. And the same problem surfaces in the short story. Cintio's Moor is afraid to take Desdemona with him because sea voyages are so perilous, but Desdemona insists on coming anyway. Fortunately, the Moors' fears are misplaced. As Chintio tells us, setting sail, they pursued their voyage and with a perfectly tranquil sea arrived safely at Cyprus. While Desdemona's cruise is uneventful, both Chintio and Shakespeare have other plans for the Turkish fleet, which is destroyed at sea by storms. Verdi's storm, then, takes elements of the Shakespeare original and weaves them together, condensing plot and imagery into a sharply dramatic opening scene. This replaces the entire first act of Shakespeare, which the composer and his librettist Arrigo Boito cut. Instead, we see and hear the storm that destroys the Turkish fleet. Otello's first line, which we just heard when he steps ashore, is "Esultate, l'orgoglio musulmano sepolto in mar." Rejoice, the Turk's pride is buried in the sea. And Verdi has simultaneously managed to associate the story's hero with the sound of a lone, defiant trumpet. Verdi even manages to salvage the one thing he might have lost by cutting Shakespeare's first act. The original Chintio story never names Othello. In fact, no one in the short story has a name except Desdemona. Othello is the Moor, Iago is the ensign, and Roderigo is the captain. In Shakespeare's hands, this becomes a literary device. Although he names his characters, he withholds the name of the hero until well into Act I. When other characters speak about Othello, they refer to him as the Moor or the Barbary Horse. The hero is an outsider and as such a mystery, something that Verdi establishes with Otello's dramatic entrance. There are a multitude of operas based on Shakespeare, but Otello is one of the few that can truly be said to be as great, maybe even greater, than the original play. With the army ashore celebrating their easy victory, Iago begins to plot against his general. He is jealous of Otello and swears to destroy him, which he hopes to do by manipulating Roderigo, who is in love with Desdemona, and Cassio, a captain in Otello's army. The soldiers celebrate over a bonfire. The merriment builds seamlessly in Verdi's score, while Iago succeeds in getting Cassio drunk. This leads to a near riot when the former governor of the island, Montano, calls Cassio to guard duty and discovers that he's drunk. Iago tells Montano that Cassio is always drunk, Roderigo laughs at the hapless captain, and a brawl breaks out that is only quenched by the appearance of Otello. Otello trusts Iago, and taking his word for how it all started, he demotes Cassio. The act ends with quiet restored, and Otello and Desdemona recall how they first fell in love. That is often called the kiss theme. And if Verdi was so sure that Wagner was all wrong, it sounds as if he did not entirely reject the idea of leitmotifs. It also sounds a bit like the Tristan prelude. The duet that ends Act I is not found in Shakespeare's play, nor is one of the most gripping moments at the beginning of Act II, Iago's so-called credo. I believe in a cruel God, Iago tells the audience, who created me in his own image. The conversion of Shakespeare's more nuanced Iago into a creature of monolithic evil was in part the doing of Verdi's librettist for Otello, Arrigo Boito. Verdi's junior by almost 30 years, Boito was a well-established Italian poet and composer of the younger generation. The two men had not always seen eye to eye. In fact, Boito advocated the incorporation of foreign influences into Italian opera as a way of rejuvenating the art form. One of his favorite foreign influences was, not surprisingly, Wagner. That would have put the two men at loggerheads by itself, but Boito also felt that he had been personally slighted and belittled by Verdi. After the premiere of what would be Boito's best-known work and only complete opera, Mefistofele, Verdi commented that Boito aspires to originality but succeeds only at being strange. The distance between the two men might not have mattered had Verdi stayed retired after the premiere of Aida. But it was the ardent wish of Verdi's publisher Giulio Ricordi to persuade Verdi to return to composing. As an interim step, Verdi was persuaded to do a revision of his earlier opera, Simon Boccanegra. Part of the problem with the original had been a convoluted plot, and Verdi was pleasantly surprised at how adept Boito proved to be in fixing the problems. When the revised edition premiered at La Scala in 1881, the reception was ecstatic, and Verdi was grateful to the young Boito. Verdi had always loved Shakespeare. His early opera Macbeth had had limited success, and for almost his entire adult career, the composer would toy with the idea of setting King Lear. This, to Ricordi, seemed the way in. Boito, too, was a Shakespeare aficionado, and the publisher used this when he pushed both men to collaborate on a new opera. Boito was enthusiastic, but Verdi was guarded. He read Boito's first draft of a libretto and praised it. He refused to give many comments because, as he told Ricordi, he didn't want to commit himself to the project, even by implication. In the end, Boito's and Ricordi's enthusiasm won out. Boito would actually be Verdi's librettist for two Shakespeare projects, Otello and the composer's final opera, Falstaff. Falstaff amalgamates three of the bard's plays, but for Otello, both composer and librettist worked hard to preserve as much as possible of the original Shakespeare. They cut the first act, but Shakespeare devotees had long considered that the weakest. Samuel Johnson, writing in the 18th century, wished that Shakespeare himself had omitted his Act I. Had the scene opened in Cyprus, he wrote, and the preceding incidents been occasionally related, there had been little wanting to a drama of the most exact and scrupulous regularity. The second act of Verdi's opera is almost entirely taken up with the evil plotting of his Iago. Iago plants the idea in Otello's mind that Desdemona is having an affair with Cassio, and then strengthens the Moor's suspicions by persuading Desdemona to plead with Otello to reinstate Cassio after his Act I demotion. Finally, Iago steals Desdemona's handkerchief so he can use it as proof that she is bestowing favors on Cassio. In both the play and the opera, Desdemona's handkerchief is described as having strawberries on it, which in the 19th century led to an odd misunderstanding. A historian friend of art critic John Ruskin, Rawdon Brown, took the strawberries as proof of a real-life inspiration for the Shakespearean original. The family crest of Cristoforo Moro, an actual Venetian doge of the 15th century, displayed three mulberries, and Brown suggested that Shakespeare must have confused the family name Moro with the identical Italian word for Moor. Brown and Ruskin were almost certainly wrong, if for no other reason than the textual importance of Othello being an outsider. But if a Venetian guidebook directs you to Othello's house, it's based on this misidentification. Othello was not necessarily black in Shakespeare. This came later in performance. Elizabethan England recognized a wide range of complexions as not being white, and Shakespeare, like his source Cintio, may well have been thinking of a dark-skinned North African. But they were certainly not thinking about someone as central to the Venetian power structure as a doge, or even the relative of a doge. Othello is compelling because he is exotic, and his passion, both his temper and the depth of his jealousy, are indications of his barbarian antecedents. The marital disagreement over Cassio grows more heated in Act 3. Iago states a conversation with Cassio in which he draws him out about his amorous adventures. Iago has placed Othello in hiding, and since he is only able to overhear what Iago wants him to overhear, Othello emerges convinced that his wife has betrayed him. Where Boito made his Iago shallower and more simply evil, his Othello is a rich character, racked with pain over his wife's supposed infidelity. In the Moore's aria, Dio mi potevi, he asks God why he took from him the one thing that mattered most. Verdi captures Othello's pain by reducing the aria to almost a monotone. Othello sings the same note literally 16 times, only descending to a second note at the very end of the phrase. Othello asks Iago for advice on how to kill his wife. Iago proposes strangulation. She should die in the same bed where she betrayed her husband. He promises to kill Cassio himself. Though brutal, Iago's method is uncharacteristically straightforward for such a schemer. In the Cintio original, both men have enough presence of mind to realize that it would be better not to be caught. A plan comes to mind which will give you satisfaction and raise no suspicion, Cintio has his Iago say to Othello. The house in which you live is very old, and the ceiling of your chamber has many cracks. I propose we take a stocking, filled with sand, and beat Desdemona with it till she dies. Thus will her body bear no signs of violence. When she's dead, we can pull down a portion of the ceiling and thus make it seem as if a rafter falling on her head has killed the lady. Suspicion cannot rest on you, since all men will impute her death to accident. It's what they do, and they do, in fact, get away with it. But such an end was both too impersonal and too dispassionate for Shakespeare or Verdi. Although Othello's murder of his wife is premeditated, it must have the feeling of a crime of passion. The act ends with news from Venice. The Doge has recalled Othello and promoted the disgraced Cassio to take his place as governor of the island. If Othello is going to act, he must do so quickly. In the final act, Verdi accentuates the horror of Othello's misjudgment by showing Desdemona at her most innocent and vulnerable. Her famous willow song recalls another betrayed lover, and Desdemona's sob-like cries of Salce, Salce, willow, willow are echoed in the orchestra by the English horn. Otello confronts Desdemona. In a heartrending coda, Otello asks if she has already said her prayers. He does not want her to die condemned. We have already heard her Ave Maria before Otello's arrival. Otello accuses Desdemona of having an affair with Cassio, which she vehemently denies. He tells her that Cassio is already dead. Otello takes her surprise as proof of her guilt, and the scene builds to its inevitable climax. Desdemona's servant Emilia bursts in with the news that Cassio lives. He has murdered Roderigo. Emilia, knowing how the handkerchief came to be in Cassio's possession, exposes Iago's deception. Overcome, Otello stabs himself and gives the dead body of his innocent wife a final kiss before dying.